trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis State. Don, it was weird last week. What happened?
It was hot yesterday. We were over 100 degrees in Davis. 102, I think, is what we ultimately hit on Tuesday afternoon. We are recording this show July 15th, Wednesday, for broadcast on July 16th. And Sunday and Monday were strange weather here in the Davis area. The North America monsoon is a phenomenon. It's the name that's being applied to what I learned as the Mexican monsoon way back when I was studying atmospheric sciences long, long, long ago. This is a big pattern. I'm just going to quote my favorite weather person in the world right here, Daniel Swain, describing the North American monsoon. As a reminder for folks, it refers not to a storm. It's not like, oh, a monsoon is coming in. It's a seasonal reversal in wind patterns that often brings an increase in humidity and or precipitation. It is not in itself a singular precipitation event. It is not a monsoon coming in. It is, we are in monsoon season. Warm air is coming up off of the ocean, goes over a large plain, and just spills out all its rainfall over a very wide area. And this all comes up over New Mexico, Arizona, southeastern California, up into the Great Basin, which is Nevada and surrounding areas, and into the Central Valley. And what they were telling us on Friday was that this monsoon air would push up, certainly into the southern San Joaquin Valley, probably into parts of the Central Valley. There would be a chance of dry lightning on the Coast Range. And fortunately, that didn't happen as far as I know. And there would be a chance of thunderstorms over on the at the base of the Sierra. This is because that air is very wet and very warm and then is elevating very rapidly at our end when it starts to hit the mountain ranges. So it squeezes the water out there. What we experience isn't rain typically. We have very warm and surprisingly moist air by our standards coming up off the Gulf of California, the Gulf of Baja California, not the Gulf of Mexico, coming in over us. And as I say, into southeastern California, Barstow, places like that, we're expected to get sudden rainfall in the kind of torrential desert downpours that they're used to down there. They come in, it pours on them, they're gone. My daughter was posted at San Angelo, Texas, which is an Air Force base in the middle of absolutely nowhere in western Texas. And they would be hot as could be in just, I mean, miserable weather, perfect for training for the military. And then they look out to the south and they'd see these armada of clouds coming towards them that would come over them. They'd all be cheering it and it would be pouring on them for 15 minutes and they'd get 1 or 2 inches of rain all at once. They'd be gone. It would be steamy and then they'd be back to hot as blazes. That's monsoon time. And so we don't see that here very often. But I was going back through an old desk drawer recently and found some notes I made from August of 1981. I used to take weather notes from way back then, just as my mother did. And I wrote down for 2 weeks in August, unusually humid, weird, overcast, awful weather is roughly what I wrote down. And that's what we would experience this far north from that air moving in is just, by our standards, muggy air coming in. Some turbulence, so there's a chance of showers, but not much by the time it plays out at our end of things, although it can. And as you know, if you're from Arizona, New Mexico, places like that, they can get a significant amount of rainfall from any single one of these storms as they pass over. And it's true in San Diego County, Riverside County, southeastern California. We were on the edge of one of those. It came over us as I was driving in Sunday morning. It was spitting at me as I drove in Monday morning, a little bit of rainfall. Unfortunately, interesting as this is, it's really bad for agriculture. When you get that kind of humidity and just a little bit of rainfall and it's still in the 80s and even into the 90s, that is fungus weather. That's all it does is encourage fungus. It splatters spores from plant to plant, from place to place. As I drove in, I smelled the distinctive smell of agricultural fungicides being applied on the tomato crop and undoubtedly on some of the tree crops in the area as well. For home gardeners, the one concern I do have from this is diseases on grapes. And this is going to be really tough for the wine grape growers. This is about the worst timing they could have for this kind of weather, given the present state of their, you know, of ripening of the wine grapes. You get moisture on the fruit as it's ripening. The waxy coating may be thinning on the fruit a little bit as it gets closer to ripening. They're dense in there with foliage around them. Bunch rot, downy mildew, problems like that can inoculate and spread very quickly. You, as a home gardener, can do exactly what some of the wine grape growers will be doing this week, most likely already doing. They go out and they thin out the vines a bit. They take some of the foliage off. They do a little pruning to get air circulation around the fruit. In some cases, in the case of red wine grapes, they actually do it to get them more exposed to sunlight because that will intensify the color. Perhaps have some effect on the flavor as well, but especially intensify the color. The main advantage of this is that you get air circulation around the grapes. If your clusters are touching each other, remove some of them. I know that's really hard to do. Remove either some grapes or some of the clusters. If you have any fruit on a tree where there's points of contact between the fruit, this would be a good time to take some of them off if you have to, or at least monitor them. And those are areas where you're likely to see spoilage get in as the fruit is ripening. Maybe harvest a little bit before they're soft ripe. That goes for your peaches and plums and things like that. I expect to see more spoilage on things like grapes, strawberries, and some kinds of stone fruits, particularly peaches and nectarines concern me because they're relatively softer, thinner skin. That's the main effect this will have. And of course, we fully expect to see a lot of leaf diseases on plants briefly. Someone showed me a picture of late blight on one little piece of their tomato plant. What do? I said, prune it out and throw it away. End of problem. That's all we have to do here. But there are places where that would be a real concern. This is what kind of starts the process. As we always say here on the show, this week's weather is next week's problems. So it rains Sunday, Monday. So next Sunday, Monday, I expect you'll be seeing some leaf diseases. Mostly, they're things you can just remove, prune out, pick off, throw away, rather than going out and finding some fungus out. You're not a farmer. You don't need to worry about that kind of thing.
So if we had high humidity for a couple of days,
yep,
and that's causing these fungus problems, so we're back down to normal, or maybe we'll even have low humidity.
Yeah.
Will that cure the problem? Would putting a fan out on my little cure the problem? Is there anything you can do, or is there anything that's going to get better?
Well, we were joking about this at the nursery. I mean, when you have bedding plants that are all packed close together in a flat and you have flowers like a big fluffy marigold, flowers are touching each other. If you get any kind of disease, even things like botrytis, which we talk about more back in the winter, it'll rapidly move from petal to petal, from flower to flower. So deadheading, not my favorite pastime, but this is a time when deadheading might reduce the spoilage of blooms in your flower border. Thinning things out a little bit, trimming back, yes, that's the one thing you can do. And watch for these diseases. Yes, the low humidity that we're already back to. Just for the record, our lowest humidity on one of those days was 46%.
Probably high for us.
For us, yeah. I mean, normally we're in the 25% range as our low humidity. And when we have a north wind, it's even lower than that. So you go back to, earlier in the month, it was 26% was the low humidity, 29%. You don't get very many fungus diseases establishing when the humidity is dropping that low midday, day after day. But we did have a few days there where it was 37%, 37%, 40%, and 46% one day. So that's moist enough, long enough into the daytime, long enough into the night that a fungus or bacterial thing could spread. Yes, we're back to normal ET rates and humidities. It was interesting to look actually at the CIMIS station report. Normally at this time of year, we're using about a little over a quarter inch of water a day. It's 0.25 to 0.28 inches per day, if you happen to know how that plays out in terms of gallons per square foot. Great. The main point is a relative thing. We're typically about a quarter inch a day, maybe as high as 0.3 on a hot, dry day. Those 2 days that were very muggy, the ET rate was only 0.19, and one of them was 0.15. So the humidity dropped the ET rate by 40% on July 13th compared to what it typically would be. As for the rest of the week, it looks like it's going to be 92 degrees the day of the broadcast and then dropping rapidly to 86 on Friday. So 102 on Tuesday and 86 on Friday. That's pretty good in 1 week. Friday night will be 54. Saturday will be 90. Saturday night, 56 and partly cloudy. Sunday, 86 and mostly sunny. Sunday night, mostly cloudy. 56, so a little more humidity coming in. Monday, mostly sunny and only 84 degrees on Monday. Monday night, 57 and Tuesday, 88. quick look at the forecast discussion. They are still seeing these plumes of monsoon moisture pushing up. The question is how far they'll go. There will be some thunderstorms as we get into end of the week. Southern Cascades, Shasta County Coast Range could have some. There's development of possible thunderstorm activity in the Coast Range. Thursday and Friday, onshore flow, delta breeze will increasingly help to cool conditions off for parts of the valley. Our pattern on this side has been that's coming in earlier and stronger than generally expected. So we've been getting that nice coastal breeze. We have events to mention. You've got one in front of you there.
I've got the Iris Society, which is a wonderful group of folks. And every year they have this iris rhizome sale. So if you want to get some irises, it's a good time to do it. Go to the Sacramento Garden and Arts Center. And that used to be called what?
Shepherd Garden and Arts Center.
Okay, same place. Just new name. Saturday, August 1st from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Drop in and have a good iris time.
On that same day, Saturday, August 1st, is Harvest Day. Fair Oaks Horticulture Center, which is 15 or 20 minutes down the road, and it's all on the same day, but there's enough time in that day you could probably get to both of these things. The Harvest Day 2026 is free. No animals allowed. Please don't bring your pets except for trained service animals. There's ample bike parking. It says here, bring your camera.
Oh, yeah.
And origami in the water efficient landscape garden. You can make an origami seed packet or a critter anytime from 8:30 to noon. That's right up here under general information.
Well, that's because it goes all morning.
Most
of these things are very specific. Like
yeah,
the keynote speakers. You got some of those listed.
Yeah, Matthew Ampersand talking about growing food like you mean it. Eating homegrown food year round. Great topic. 9:45.
And that's at 8:30.
Right, 8:30. First, he's the first keynote speaker. 9:45 to 10:30, Rachel Davis, Future-Friendly Gardening, Grow with Purpose. And 11 to 11:45, John Kupkowski, What Are You Doing? Got to say that right. What Are You Doing? Practices for Success in Conservation in Irrigation. Great topic.
Now these are not drop-ins. You got to be there at the beginning because this is a person who's going to give you a talk.
Yep, that's at the speaker's tent. And then there's mini talks throughout the day, like some like it hot, some like it cold, talking about backyard composting, leveling up your gardening for the birds. Pruning cane berries. There's a good one. Tea party in the herb garden. Meet the stars for herb tea. Fruit trees in the orchard. Tried and true and many brand new. Basil, not just for pizza. I like that. Worm wrangling 101. Yes, you can. Joys and challenges of growing berries. Oh, I know about that one. I could tell you the joys. Berries are wonderful. The challenges, keeping them in bounds. And then hands-on fun brings us back to the origami seed packet or animal, which is going on all morning. So that's all in the morning.
They have a whole bunch of educational tables. Yeah. So, I mean, it lists for page after page. So if you want to know more about other organizations, go over there and check it out.
UCANR.edu, UC Master Gardener, Sacramento County, Harvest Day, August 1st, same day as the iris rhizome sale. You're going to be so busy that day. Here's the good news about iris rhizomes. You don't have to rush home and plant them. You've got time. They'll hold. They're really tough. My grandfather in the 1970s, gave us a bunch of rhizomes of his variety called Eleanor Roosevelt. So we know roughly when it was introduced to the market. And it was a short, vivid purple, reblooming iris. I still have that one to this day, 50 plus years later. He gave them to us in summer. And 9 months later, I found them in my garage in the bucket, which he'd given them to us in. And I thought, uh-oh. So I took them out and I planted them. I still have those plants 50 plus years later. So irises are pretty tough and pretty forgiving. They're very easy to grow and grow just about anywhere as long as you have at least some sunshine.
Ashdale wrote to us again.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Dear Don and Lois, I would appreciate Don's insight as a farmer and horticulturist on the following. I'm looking to buy property where I have enough space to grow most of my food. I have a rough concept of how much space that would be, but I have no idea if I'm being overzealous or underestimating how much space it would actually take. I know that I would want about 1,000 square feet for veggies, and then a large majority of which will be taken up by raised beds. Outside of that, I would design for vine crops.
So basically what we're looking for is a discussion of year-round harvest and the ability to grow pretty much, I'm not going to say all your food, but have something from your garden year-round, and majority of your vegetables and fruit you can certainly do. If you're vegan or vegetarian, you can probably grow almost everything. I know people, just for the record, who successfully grow most of what they eat just in a normal residential setting. As long as they are not looking for meat or anything like that, they buy that at the grocery store. I know a gentleman whose backyard is all raised beds and planters, and somewhere along the line, they're not vegan, so they got chickens, and so they have their own eggs now because of that. And that's just in a normal backyard, but that takes some planning. And it also takes a lot of pruning on the fruit trees. He's got a lot of different kinds of fruit trees, and they're all basically being grown as fruit shrubs. I have numerous customers that I've known over the years who have gotten so much production out of just a normal residential backyard. It has to be full sun. This is really important. You know, there's none of these that do well in the shade. You can actually grow all your own fruit and all your own vegetables. Your starting point would be the ripening periods of the different fruit, because that we can give you a lot of information on, obviously, and the ripening periods of the two main vegetable crop seasons, the cool season vegetables and the warm season vegetables. We can grow year round here, everywhere in coastal California, everywhere in Southern California, everywhere in Central California. We can grow food crops year around.
Don, don't you have a chart on your business website that has the ripening periods of all the stuff? I seem to recall it's redwoodbarn.com/ripeningperiod.html.
Indeed, that covers the fruit trees, and that gives you right there, you can see, wow, between citrus and stone fruits, there is something ripening every month of the year. I also have a chart that shows all the vegetables with all the fruit trees. The one thing that you might want to take a little time to think about more carefully, rather than just delving in and choosing all these different varieties, what are the types of fruit in particular that you actually will use in the kind of quantities that your fruit trees will produce them? A plum, for example, a single plum, Santa Rosa, anything like that, can produce hundreds of fruit in about a 7 to 10 day period. So a big part of the success of the people who I know who have turned their backyards into sustainable farms is that they also tend to be food processors. That's really the key thing. They're not just eating them fresh. They're actually taking them and making fruit leather and jam, and they're freezing them, and there's canning and freezing their tomatoes and so on, which my mother did. She put something in her freezer every week, and she used something from her freezer almost every day of the year. And that was in a mild climate, San Diego, but you can accomplish that here as well. So it requires some methodical food storage, preservation, all that kind of thing, which is a whole separate skill set that some people might want to jump into first before planting seven different kinds of plums and finding, actually, that's a whole lot of plum fruit. Be a little more perhaps selective about which ones you choose. Hang time on the tree would be a real selling point if you're planting a whole lot of fruit trees. So the fact that Emerald Butte plum can be picked over almost a 2 month period compared to Santa Rosa, which falls in about 5 days, I'm exaggerating, but it sure seems like it, that would be a big advantage of Emerald Butte or Nubiana or some of the others that you can actually allow to hang on the tree. With citrus, you have the same thing. Certain citrus varieties like Gold Nugget, you can pick from March all the way into the early summer. Pixie can hang on the tree year round. So there are varieties that you can kind of hone in on that would give you a little more freedom in your life to, you know, travel and actually do things without having to worry about whether this is the weekend that all the plums come down. So that's one thing to look at, is hang time and what you'd actually use.
He did say that he is, if he gets so much produce, he might set up a little fruit stand or something.
There you go. Yeah. Or like you do, like you've done, get someone to come harvest it for the food bank. I mean, there's lots of things you can do if you have too much fruit, but a little more planning. I often suggest when a family is standing there having an argument in front of me about what kind of fruit tree to plant, what do you guys actually use? What did you actually buy at the grocery store last summer every week when you went there? Was it, do you always buy peaches every week? Or is that, you know, is that something where having 600 peaches in a 7 to 10 day period, maybe more than you want to hassle with? Maybe you'd enjoy having a mandarin that you can pick over a 3 month period instead if you're limited for space. So give that some.
Have you, And have you bought an extra chest freezer that you can make pies and freeze them for later?
There you go. Yeah. I mean, I've known people who really homestead even in a normal residential setting. So I think an acre would be great. There is a farmer, or was, I don't know if he's still giving these presentations, but he was in Sonoma County, and he was a small scale farmer who was getting really high yields from a relatively small operation. And he was very intensive about the use of organic material and different manures and all this stuff, because he was organic and even sustainable. And he had a market. He was making that work on a very small area. So you can get high yield in a small area by fairly intensive inputs, or you can just choose your crops carefully for what you actually would use and process.
I noticed in here, he said his trees, his orchard, were going to be 15 by 15 by 15 trees. That's 15 wide, 15 deep,
15 foot spacing,
and 15 tall.
Yep.
And a 4 foot walkway between the trees.
I'm going to make one suggestion there, which is that 4 foot walkway is probably not enough room width for a gardener who's got wheelbarrows and tools and a couple people helping them. Probably 6 to 8 foot wide would be better here and there, at least, or staging areas where you can put that stuff. This is what I have found over the years, is that at least a 6 foot wide path is what you're likely to want. And so 4 foot is a little tight for that. 15 by 15 spacing is tight. That's not as tight as I'm seeing orchards planted. I've seen some high density orchards even closer, but a little wider spacing for some of these might be suitable if you want to try and get in all the way around each tree to do all these operations. Visualize the tree 10 to 20 years down the road, getting in there, doing topping type of pruning, which you're going to do on some of these to keep them in picking range, getting a ladder in to pick from them. I think you'll probably want more than 4 feet between them for that. 15 foot spacing is close. That's a pretty tight spacing. That implies you're going to do summer pruning for size control, or you're going to choose dwarfer plants. And some of the things that are on here are, in fact, dwarfer plants. Figs are a good example. If you plant a fig and do nothing, most of these varieties will get 20 to 30 feet with equal spread with no problem. But if you choose Violette de Bordeaux, which I notice is on here, or Blackjack, those only grow about a foot a year, and they're very easily kept like shrubs. So there are varieties, in almost every case, there are varieties that will reduce the amount of input, the amount of work you have to do. If you don't want to do a lot of pruning on peaches and nectarines, for example, there are the miniatures. They used to sell them as genetic dwarf was the term that was used. Now they're selling them as miniature or dwarf peaches and nectarines. The first ones that came on the market didn't have the best flavor. They were okay, but they weren't like 9 on a scale of 10. They were more like 6 on a scale of 10. There are new ones that Dave Wilson Nursery from Floyd Zager's research firm have introduced that are very good quality. They're limited supply, but you want to keep an eye out for them. You can plant those like a shrub that happens to grow peaches or nectarines. Isn't that great? And you never have to prune them except maybe a little thinning or size control many years down the road. So if you want to have a lot of fruit in a smallish space and you don't want to do a lot of late summer pruning or even a lot of winter pruning on them, look for some of the miniatures. I noticed, for example, his pomegranate on here, Parfianca, is a more compact grower, so it doesn't require as much care. The others, you can just allow to get big. Who cares how big your persimmon gets? They're beautiful trees. If you only pick 20 of them and it has 500, I guarantee the cedar waxwings will help you out on that problem. So the persimmons are a wonderful tree to put at the edge of your fruit orchard, right where you walk out into the wilder area and your permaculture layout, because there's sort of a nice bridge tree between formal orchard and informal landscape.
So on your questions, the one about, are there any major harvesting gaps?
I will tell you the usual problem times are late summer into early fall. Apples and pears are August to September. Apples, August is early, although one does ripen early. There are some that ripen later, and that would be the way to stretch the season. But again, be aware, this is the other thing to look at, the maintenance and the inputs on these different crops. And apples are an example of one that you either have to spray or you have to protect the fruit directly. So it's a higher input crop to get good unblemished fruit to the table. That's another factor that you might want to consider on some of these. If you had cherries on here, for example, which you don't, but if you had cherries on here, we'd have a long conversation about what you have to do to get cherries without worms in them. So there are some fruit that are easier than others. I have a chart on my website that's on a scale of 0 to 5, how easy it is to get good fruit to the table. And the reason I did this was because of the constant input I got from people that, peaches are a hassle. You have to do this. You have to do that. You have to spray for peach leaf growers. You don't have to spray for it. You'll get perfectly good fruit if you don't spray for it in most cases. Many people wish to spray for one reason or another, but getting good fruit to the table isn't that difficult with peaches, but they're pretty high input with respect to pruning and training, or else they'll collapse from the weight of the fruit. So, you know, there are some fruit that are easier to grow than others. And many of the things on here, the citrus, are very low input. Pineapple guava is on here. Quince are on here. Persimmons, figs, pomegranates are all very low input fruit producing plants. There are a few things on here that are perhaps a little more work. Again, talking about the peaches and nectarines. The mulberry that he chose is a dwarf type. I highly recommend that because a regular mulberry is a big plant and requires a lot of pruning, or else it's just going to overwhelm the other plants nearby. So with that 15 by 15 spacing, some of them are going to need more than that. A regular fig, for example, some would be fine with considerably less. Citrus, for example, could be kept much smaller. In the case of all the mandarins that are listed, they could easily be kept 8 feet across. I have mandarins that are 15 years old, 20 years old, that are taking up a total of about 8 to 10 feet of space. And I've never pruned those at all. I have others that I've kept even smaller than that with no difficulty. So it depends on how much maintenance you're going to put in, but choosing the varieties for a tighter growth habit and lower input, I think, is going to be a real important part of this process.
So his other questions, he says, would I be able to maintain this while being able to do other hobbies? Sure. And if not, what sort of adjustments should I make?
Get rid of the other hobbies. That's easy. are there other hobbies? I don't. Most woody fruit producing things don't require a lot of input except for irrigation, except that most of them have rather specific pruning that is either needed or is traditional. Take your pick. Sometimes it's done even though it's not absolutely necessary. In most cases, it's done for size control, fruit access, or ease of orchard operations. So when we had a pruning service as a nursery, we offered a dormant pruning service for years. Very popular. We had 80 or 90 customers for whom we did that. They had us come in, they paid once a year. So this is one thing to think about. They paid once a year for a service in which we came in and pruned their fruit trees for them. And in most cases, the average backyard, it was 4 to 6 labor hours for just sort of a typical yard with a few fruit trees. This would be a lot. So you'd be paying a lot more once they're more established. Again, a big advantage to more compact growing varieties would be, wouldn't be as much work. It'd be something even a maintenance gardener could probably do. You wouldn't have to have a tree service or a specialty pruner as long as you were there to give them guidance about what you're after. So the pruning would be the one thing that would be a fairly high input thing at 2 times a year, late summer for the size control, which anybody can do, and winter for those that are appropriately pruned in the winter for structural work. And that's where you do want to have someone who knows more what they're doing, because you're doing actual structure, safety, balance of the tree, and trying to reduce fruit load in most cases so the tree will be better and can give you better quality. So the pruning is going to be the big thing. Irrigation, you can set that up so it's automatic. You know, you can, that's easy enough to do. And the training is something you'll work on, but that's, again, a once or twice a year thing. You don't really have to do that much input. Most of what I'm seeing here with respect to the woody fruit producing things would not be super high input. It would be that annual pruning event.
And his last question is, would this be sustainable into old age? And speaking as an old age woman who is not allowed to climb ladders anymore, that I think is going to be the biggest thing, is to you'll have to hire someone to climb the ladders that you're no longer able to climb. If you get to a place where you can't touch the ground, then you're going to have to hire someone to do the
But you can prevent the ladder thing just by making sure that you keep the plants smaller. And in most cases, they have, the choices here have been for smaller growers, such as the dwarf mulberry, for example. Okay. You would need not need a ladder. So you need to know which ones will need more maintenance as you age. Also, this is real important. Stone fruits have a lifespan. They're short-lived. 25 years is getting old for a peach. Commercial orchards and home gardens, 15 to 25 years is the lifespan for peaches, plums, nectarines, apricots, things like that. Yes, of course, they can live longer. I've seen much older ones, but typically a hard-pruned, heavily cropped, that is to say, you're growing it for fruit, you're pushing it for that purpose. 20 years, you're beginning to decline. 25 years, most people are finding it's ready for them to come out and be replaced. So as far as that goes, since Ashdale is not in his 60s or 70s, I think those trees will be long gone. But citrus can live for decades. Many of the other plants on here can live, can just become permanent plants. You got pineapple guava, for example. Cool, let it grow into a tree if you lose interest in the fruit. It's a fantastic large shrub or small tree. Pomegranate, same same thing can last for decades and decades. So with respect to the stone fruits, they have a lifespan. Palm fruits, apples and pears, can be much longer lived. There are apple trees that live for decades and decades with just periodic renewal pruning to open them up and reduce disease problems and so forth. So many of these things could be very long lived and just be allowed to grow out once you lose interest or you don't care about some of the fruit being out of reach. That's absolutely fine. I have helped people who have aged out of intensive gardening. So when we have kids and families and we plant vegetable gardens and we show how you make sauce and you put it in the freezer and all that kind of stuff, you plant 15 or 20 tomato plants. And I've had people who have, of course, aged out of that. The kids have grown, moved away. They still have the same area they laid out before. They're maybe only planting 2 tomatoes instead of 30. I remember one guy saying, well, I just can't imagine not having one tomato plant. I'm thinking, I can't imagine only having one tomato plant, but that's fine. So I sold him Juliet, just for the record, because I thought there's a good all-purpose tomato that'll do whatever you want. You can travel, you can come back, they'll still be out there, still producing. I've helped them change over their vegetable beds from, you know, that kind of intensive planting. Well, herb gardens are really simple. You know, take perennial herbs, woody plants like rosemary. How about cut flowers? You could plant Shasta daisies and Gilardias and Rudbeckias in one of them. You can turn them into really cool flower gardens or herb gardens or something like that, rather than knocking them down and just abandoning the whole thing. I will mention that there's two periods in here that are going to be a little more challenging for you, other than I mentioned late summer, early fall. April to May is before your summer vegetables are coming in, before your stone fruits are typically coming in. There are some early ripening varieties, but honestly, they sometimes have issues and there just aren't that many that are real good. So to me, April and May are berry months. That's when blueberries are ripening. That's when strawberries start ripening and heavily ripen into May and June. And that's when the first of the blackberry group are ripening. The blackberries, the cane berries, the boysenberries, loganberries, all that kind of thing. He's got a lullaberry on here in June, but there's actually berries that ripen in May as well. Just be aware, that's not a low maintenance plant, okay? Cane berries can escape. And where you are in Sonoma County, boy, have they done so. So be very cautious where you plant cane berries and be sure to put it in a place where you can confine it. I notice there's only one on here, so it hasn't gone like way overboard on cane berries, as for example.
Maybe strawberries.
Well, strawberries, yeah, they're no problem. They don't run all over the place. But I've planted cane berries 3 times on my farm. And if you're walking around here, you can see exactly where those 3 places were. And they're now wildlife habitat. And then there's disease and pest issues that you need to be aware of. For example, I see loquat on here in May. I don't sell loquats because they're extremely susceptible to fire blight. I want people to know that when they look for one, and there's no control for it, and it can kill the whole plant or at least half the plant all at once in a bad fire blight year. So that's something to be aware of. There's some of the plants that would require more special attention. I mentioned cherries, you don't have them on here, but fire blight on loquats is another example. Cuddling moth in apples, something to be aware of that requires rather special attention. So you think about whether you want a lot of something that would require you to spray or bag the fruit. I'm looking at this one. The one part that could end up being higher input is the, quote, vine crops, which is grapes and kiwis and things like that. Those tend to be high input just because of how vigorous they are. So as you think about that, think about, are those things you use, first of all? I mean, people come in and ask me about kiwi fruit. It drives us crazy because kiwis have so many issues getting them established and labeling problems and whatnot. But I've known people who had successful producing kiwis, and it's a lot of pruning. We used to prune them for people every now and then. They get to be a giant tangle if you don't prune them. And they would get typically 6 grocery sacks full of kiwi fruit in the month of October, which is when you pick them. And you have to store them. And all of them made the same comment. That's a lot of kiwi fruit. I don't know how much you like kiwi, but it's a lot to deal with. Yes, it stores pretty well into the winter. You can store them carefully into December, January, but it's still a great deal of fruit for a fair bit of input on your part. So my question would be, do you like kiwis that much? Grapes, on the other hand, you can prune them really hard and still get good fruit production, depending on the type. You need to choose them fairly carefully. But a single grape that I planted 3 years ago on a long section of fence in my vegetable garden has grown 3 years, 40 feet. Because I've allowed it to do that. It's covering that whole fence for me. So that's what they're capable of doing. They're capable of climbing up into nearby trees. They're capable of running across the ground and here and there rooting if they happen to be, you know, covered with grassy weeds and whatnot. I am speaking from experience here. They can get away from you if you aren't careful. So plan that structure carefully and plan it for ease of pruning, especially grapes, because you do have to prune them every year, else they get very, very overgrown. You get more disease problems and you start to get rats and tree squirrels and so forth in there. So put them in a place where it'll be easy to get up on a ladder, maybe a 6-foot ladder or less, and do pretty severe pruning on them. The biggest mistakes I've seen with grapes are putting them on an arbor structure that you can't get up into and prune. So, and the person ends up having to like stand on the arbor in order to prune them, which is not safe. So whatever structure you put them on, I would recommend it be something you can work from ground level and prune, and make it easy to prune from both sides. So you don't put this on a fence next to your neighbor, for example, where it's going to run into their yard. So the vine crops need some careful attention, just as the cane berries need some special attention with respect to placement. I just want to add one more thing to this whole comment about feeding yourself with fruit and vegetables and whatnot year round. I went through this exercise in the early 1980s when we first bought this property over 40 years ago of let's grow as many things that we can eat as possible. You know, you're buying a farm, you should be growing food. And yeah. I remember, you know, this is before the internet. This is before personal computers. We had memo pads out writing down the things we wanted. None of the varieties that Ashdale listed were available then.
They didn't exist.
Most of them didn't exist. The pluots, the pluaries, the apriums, many of the newer forms of peaches and nectarines. Whole new category of fruit was created by Floyd Zager 40, 50 years ago. The pluot and all the other similar interspecific hybrids. I wouldn't be surprised if something similar comes along. The seedless mandarins are a big deal now in the marketplace, so they're going to be a big deal in the home garden. And there's going to be more varieties coming on the market as breeders meet market demand. There are more blueberry varieties right now by far than we had 20 years ago. It used to be that if we could get blueberries at all, there'd be two or three varieties and we'd have long conversations with people about them. Now I can get 15 different varieties of blueberries. Now that's a big change in just the last couple decades. So there's more to come, especially as breeders plan for disease issues, you know, that they can see in the future, plan for drought tolerance, plan for ease of maintenance, and continue with this direction of plants for gardeners with limited space, where it gives you a chance to try more fruit in a small space area. For example, the area between your vegetable garden and your orchard could have a few dwarf peaches as a hedge or as shrubs. They could be mixed with clementine mandarins, which could be kept shorter. So from a permaculture standpoint, the use of the layout based on usage, you would be able to bridge some of those areas with these transitional plantings of new varieties that are just coming on the market now.
So the next one, I'm really glad to see this. Someone posted on Nextdoor, which is our community talk to each other site, yes. And about alligator lizards. Do we have them here? Are they good guys in the yard?
Good guys. Don,
I found alligator lizards in my yard. I was astonished. And it was in an area that I hadn't done anything with for a long time. And the leaves had piled up about, I don't know, eight inches tall. Yeah, I had left a brick out there and then it got piled up. And so it's like 4 inches on top of that. And inside one of those decorative bricks, there were two alligator lizards. So as I was cleaning up, I found them.
Yeah, they're great.
They're wonderful. They're great. Were the San Francisco alligator lizards.
Okay, there's a southern alligator lizard. I grew up with these in San Diego. They're very common.
But that's the southern. This is the
I assume so, yes. I don't know exactly how you tell them apart, but yes, we do have them here. I hate to talk about good guys and bad guys. I really wish we wouldn't see the world in those kinds of terms. But in the garden, they don't do any harm to any of your plants, if that's what you mean, and they feed on things like black widows. So you tell me, something that eats black widows, is that a good guy or a bad guy? Apparently immune to the spider's venom, according to one seemingly reputable website. Oh, Wikipedia. So I'll go with that one. They eat all kinds of things. Slugs, they eat other lizards. They eat small mammals. They eat young birds and eggs. This is a very large lizard. I always assumed it was called the alligator lizard because it looks like a small alligator. There may be some other reason, but they do, just so you know. Remember, I was a boy growing up in Southern California when it was not fully developed. So we had mesas and canyons and places to go hiking where we were unsupervised, and we would find these things. They do bite. I can tell you they do bite. They bite hard. It hurts. So don't pick them up. If you grab them by the tail, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds, don't do this. Don't do this. Don't even think about it. I know I just put this in your head, but don't even think about it. The tail will probably come off in your hand. It's one of these lizards that has a detaching, if you will, tail. There's another term for it. But it is a little disconcerting at first because then it flops around because the nerve endings are still going. And it does that for quite a while, surprisingly long time, 10, 15 minutes, I can tell you from the experience of someone I know quite well. And then the lizard itself scampers off, tailless now. It can grow a new tail, just for the record. So you haven't ruined its life completely. But they do bite. They bite hard. They eat a lot of good things in the garden, and they can lose their tail. Those are the relevant data points. We mostly have the Western fence lizard here. All lizards are entirely beneficial in the garden. I did have a customer come in earlier in the spring who was wanting to know how to get rid of lizards in their yard. And of course, our reaction to that is
moving into an apartment building when you're on the fourth floor.
Our reaction to that is that we want to tell them that lizards are good, but it's because we're using the good or bad terminology. His wife really didn't like lizards. His wife was scared of lizards. She found them very freaky. And so he wanted to know how to get rid of them. The answer to that, if for some reason you want to get rid of them, or flipping this around, if you want to encourage them, focus on habitat. Western fence lizard, well, there's a reason for the name, but what they really like is piles of wood, rocks, places where they can, you watch them, where they can scamper in and hide in the shade in the dark area, come out, sit in the sun, run back in there. So clean up piles of debris, piles of wood, stacks of rocks. If you want to encourage them, a short rock wall is one of the best things you can do here to bring them in. Have moisture nearby. They really like to be near moisture. They don't need it all the time, but they like in my garden, the gravel area with a short rock wall near the garden that gets watered. They love that. That's perfect for them, partly because there's food sources there and undoubtedly because there's some moisture as well. And alligator lizards are very recognizable. They describe them here as getting to 3 to 7 inches, not including the tail length. And the tail can be more than twice the body length. So I have seen these 16 to 18 inches long, including a very long tail. And you're going to want to just leave them alone, is what my mother said frequently. Leave it alone. It'll leave you alone. That was the first rule we learned about rattlesnakes and tarantulas and scorpions and alligator lizards. Because as they note here in Wikipedia, it is often found in or around suburban yards and garages, notable for its vicious self-defense, and will bite and defecate if handled. I can confirm those. I live an average 10
Don,
to
15. Stop messing with the critters.
Yes. We had a rule that we could bring these things in. My mom had a stack of aquaria, old used aquariums in the back. And you could put them in there for a little while. You could even make a little diorama for them for a little while and learn all about them. But then you had to take them and release them after a while. Because it was really hard to figure out exactly what to feed them and keep them happy. But it says here, lives on average 10 to 15 years and survives well in captivity. I am not recommending that you capture one of these and bring it into your house. I'm just saying if you did, it could live for 10 or 15 years.
Well, we have messages that have come into our mailbag. And Don, if someone wants to write to us, how do they get to us?
DavisGardenShow@gmail.com.
All right. And if you want to see our archives, DavisGardenShow.com.
Correct.
We made it so easy, didn't we?
Yeah.
So here is Caitlin from Walnut Creek who writes, I'm growing winter squash for the first time this year. I have both a kabocha squash and a spaghetti squash that look pretty ripe. They're full size. They changed colors. But how do I know if they're actually ready to harvest? July seems so early. Should I leave them on the vine until the fall to make sure they're really ready? Or will harvesting them sooner help promote the plant to make more squash? And what tips do you have for curing them for storage in our hot summer climate?
Oh, these are great for this area. I think she's in Walnut Creek.
Walnut Creek is
East
this
Bay.
This is basically the same.
Yeah, East Bay is similar in the sense that it were warm and dry and no rain from May through October, or at least middle of October.
And East Bay means over those hills.
Yes.
So they're on the interior side, and on the valley side.
Yeah, basically.
On the bay side.
Sunset Western Garden Book puts them in the same climate zone as us, zone 14, USDA zone, probably 9B, if not 10A. But in terms of summer rainfall and moisture, the same as here. You're providing all the irrigation the plant needs, and it's very low humidity during harvest season, so we don't have to worry about spoilage and things like that. One of the things that always has made winter squashes as a category so popular is that you can grow them easily. I don't even plant mine till about the 1st of June. They'll run all over the place. They'll set their fruit and it will be ready for harvest, typically about 90 days after you plant it. Harris Seeds Company, which sells seeds to what we used to call truck farmers, people with small farms who then go door to door with their trucks selling the produce, has a whole chart of different winter squash, as they call them, quick reference chart. They range from 80 days, which is really early, to 110 days from planting, which is more typical. 95 to 100 days is pretty common. So 3 months from when you plant it is typically when you can harvest. This is the thing. They do color up before they're fully sweet, I believe. And so leaving them on there to get higher sugar content would probably be desirable. So the first thing I like to go by with anything in the squash and melon group is what the packets say for the number of days. And that's a good starting point. So,
and when did you plant it?
Right. So if you planted that on May 15th, and it's a typical 90-day squash, which is true of most of these, then it would be June 15th, July 15th, August 15th, before you typically be harvesting it.
And in fact, if you plant it in April?
That would be unusual for these. They do not like cold soil. So if you plant it in April, that probably wouldn't count from April. It would probably count from when this plant actually really started growing. Although it might have been warmer in Walnut Creek than it was here. I think they're pretty similar in terms of when you plant these. So we don't typically plant these till May. And they're one of the last things I put in just because they take a lot of space. And so I'm just sticking them down on the end. And they will grow happily in very hot weather and produce all the way into September, October. The other good thing about them is that you can leave them out there. We don't get rain here that's going to spoil them. And they're pretty, even in places where it does rain, these are plants that have a waxy fruit coating. That's why they're used for storage. They have a nice tough skin. It's actually kind of hard to cut into them. And so they will store out in the garden just fine. They don't sunburn. They don't spoil. Unless you get really soggy, which would be unusual, they aren't going to rot. So typically, and there are very few pests that go after them. That's one of the reasons these became so popular with people who are trying to put food by. You can just store these intact. You can
take in the root cellar. Yeah.
In the root cellar, which we all have here in California, right? You can
not.
did you grow up with a root cellar?
Well, of course. That's where we put all the stuff that was canned.
Yeah, there you go.
It was down in the basement, and there was one door in the back, and it was not even a finished room. The basement was, but this was just carved into the dirt. So it was really a root cellar.
So even temperature year round, pretty much. Yeah. And even
all they do is throw some shelves in there and
totally different climate. My grandparents' house in Pasadena actually had two kitchens. And in the wall between the kitchens was built in this closet which connected through to the air below. So it stayed very even temperature all the time. Pasadena gets pretty hot. And it was 3 feet deep. So it had shelves in it, wire shelves in it. So you could take these squash, set them in there, and you could do that in September, and you could use those in January, February. These are things that would store well into the winter, hence the name winter squash.
When you're dealing with this and in this situation, mm-hmm. I would be tempted to go and get a handful of straw and put it underneath the squash to lift it off the soil.
Yeah.
So it wasn't directly in the soil. Is that a good plan?
Yeah, that's a good plan with your pumpkins too, if you're trying to have them look better, look more uniform, and it would reduce the possibility that there's some injury on the bottom, most commonly caused by sow bugs or something burrowing in through that skin a little bit, moisture getting in there and having the things spoil. I also once had the odd experience of gophers coming up below, this was melons, but the melons were on the ground. They were cantaloupe, so they smelled them or something, and I went to pick up cantaloupe and the entire bottom had been eaten out by the gophers. I hope you guys enjoyed yourself for that. Looking on this chart, kombucha is a 90-day squash, so I would probably not even harvest it until you've reached the 90 days, and the good news is it can sit out there for another 2, 3, 4 weeks after that with no problem, so you can keep it out there. And that, by the way, is probably the best way to prepare it for winter storage, is to just leave it out there until it's fully ripened, and it's still dry. We don't let it sit there all the way into the winter. I've had pumpkins and winter squash that were still out there in November. It had gotten rained on, 1 to 2 inches of rain. And as long as the skin was intact, they were fine. And I brought them in and we used them. So that's the other advantage, is they aren't spoiled by bad weather, at least not as quickly. So I would leave it out there as long as you can. And yes, it will probably still continue to produce. My experience with almost all of these is that you get in July, good fruit set, good rapid development. And those are the biggest ones, but it's very common for them, the butternuts and all of them, to put on another little quick late crop, and they ripen fine too. They're just smaller. They're probably not as sweet, but they taste fine for the purposes to which we put them. So I think you're on the right track to just let it grow, but I would go back and check when you planted it. As I age, I take pictures of things when I plant them. I actually, what I do is I take pictures of the label when I plant them. That's
and your camera timestamps.
That's exactly right. And so I have a record of when I plant. Even this year, I'm going, which tomatoes did I plant on May 1st? Oh, there they are. I have the labels in their own little folder. So that's one thing to do. But if you can't remember, 90 days roughly is when I would begin to consider harvesting. Nothing wrong with leaving it for a couple of weeks after that. It'll still probably produce more fruit in any event. The key with all of these things, the pumpkins, the winter squash, and this is true of cucumbers and things like that too. Anything in that family needs to keep growing. If you lose the growing point, it's just going to ripen what is set and be done. Or it may have time to form a new growing leader, but generally speaking, when I am growing cucumbers or especially pumpkins and melons, like especially these winter squashes, just run like crazy. If you lose that growing point, you're already losing leaves down at the end of the vine. This is normal. I've already talked to a couple people about this for their winter squash and their pumpkins. The plant looks fine. The picture of the plant, nice deep green, nice new growth, fruit setting, but the leaves way back near the point where it was planted, you know, the oldest leaves on the stem are beginning to yellow. Some of them have spider mites. Some of them even have mildew. I wouldn't be surprised to see more of that in the next couple of weeks. That yellowing is normal. The plant is putting its energy into the new growth. It's growing vigorously. You're watering it fine, and they need a lot of water. It's got enough nitrogen to keep that new growth coming. As long as most of the leaves are green, older leaves yellowing is a natural part of the growth cycle of the plant. It just increases as the days get shorter, increases the nights get colder. But for us, that doesn't really happen here until October. So you do have some older leaves yellowing. That's perfectly normal, I'm guessing. That doesn't mean anything about the plant shutting down, but if you lose the growing point, pretty much what's on there is going to ripen. And my experience has been that's going to be the end of it for that plant for that season.
So if I've planted a pumpkin, let's say, and it comes up and it starts running all over the place and doing its thing. Now, the place I planted it, that's still where the roots are, yep, even though the stem can be 15 feet away.
Oh, yes. Right? Yeah. So you need to water.
Do the runner, the stems, put down auxiliary roots where they touch the dirt, or is it just all from the central plant?
All from the central plant. So that's
how big is that root ball?
Oh, 5 feet deep and 5 feet across. They're big roots. They're deep-rooted plants. So yeah, that's an important question. Where you keep applying the water where the plant was planted, even though the vine is 20 feet over there. That's the first thing.
Okay, good.
Yeah, and he applied plenty of water. I learned long ago to put pumpkins and winter squash on the same line as my tomatoes, because these are equally deep-rooted. Somewhere I saw a chart of rooting depths. It was probably one of these Western agricultural handbooks that I have. And it said that pumpkins and winter squash and tomatoes have roots to a depth of 4 feet or more. Certainly believe that. Of course, that depends on your soil and your irrigation and zillion other factors. But the relative things on the chart were the important point. Peppers, 12 to 18 inches. Eggplant, 18 to 24 inches. Beans, 12 inches. Cucumbers, 12 to 18 inches. Pumpkins, winter squash, tomatoes, 4 feet plus. In my case, they're probably just going down because there's a couple of emitters at the base of the plant. That's where the water is going. I may give it several gallons of water all at once, as I typically do with these deeper rooted vegetables. I don't go out a lot because they're not branching out like a tree. This isn't like where I'm trying to get the whole quote drip line of the plant. As far as I know, the roots are predominantly where I've irrigated, and I continue to do that to keep it growing vigorously. These plants need lots of leaf area to support this developing very large fruit. Imagine what it takes for a pumpkin creates a 2,000 pound fruit. Imagine how much space that single plant has to take up. Well, I can tell you, when a guy did it on our property many years ago, he's a friend of my parents, and he wanted to try and grow a championship pumpkin. We had just bought the place, and we were still figuring out what to do with it. I said, yeah, sure, take this half acre over here. You can do whatever you want. So we planted two hills of giant pumpkin on a half acre area. And he watered them himself. They gave him 25 to 50 gallons of water each time he visited, all at once. It seems like a lot, but boy, you could see them grow. I mean, you would, I measured at one point, just like with a rough cloth tape measure in the morning, the stem, and I measured again at the end of the day when I got home, and it had grown well over a foot in a single day. And so you can imagine over the course of 2 months or so that this would cover, as it did, roughly a quarter acre. The two plants total covered about a quarter acre. And he was watering like crazy and feeding like crazy, but he was still just watering the basin he'd created for these plants. That's where he needed to put the water. That's where the roots were.
So if you didn't know this, right, and you've been watering the whole thing and,
yeah,
and
fine,
carefully watering all of those stems, 25, you know, have you harmed the plant? Do the leaves, since we're normally dry, the neat leaves would never get wet here in Davis. And if you watered them, would you damage the leaves?
No. And actually, pumpkins are grown. The first championship pumpkins were grown in Nova Scotia, which is not exactly a dry, windy climate. They do great in Oregon and places like that. Pumpkins seem to be pretty resistant to mildew and other problems. If you look through Harris Seeds and some of the other companies that sell seeds to people who grow pumpkins for jack-o'-lanterns and for commercial purposes, they will mention mildew resistance or disease tolerance of various forms. But Mendocino Coast Botanical Gardens in Fort Bragg, 1 year when I was over there, they have a big vegetable garden area up sort of at the east side of the garden, sort of out of the way where not a lot of people go walking over there. They don't have tomatoes. They didn't the time I was there. They don't have much in the way of peppers. They were in a little cold frame in the middle of the summer because it's only 62 degrees there all the time. But the pumpkins and winter squash were flourishing, taking up the whole bed. And honestly, if I lived over there, that's probably what I would grow.
Okay. I don't want to get into tomatoes real heavy, but if the older leaves are yellowing, that just means that they're old leaves, doesn't it?
On the otherwise healthy tomato plant. Yes. Yeah. This starts happening right now. I could go out and take some pictures of some of my very vigorous, healthy tomatoes. New growth is fine. Flowering and setting fine. The weather we had in July was amazing, early part of the month for fruit set. And yeah, some of the older leaves down the base are beginning to yellow. Two things. One, it could be watering related. So you might just be on the edge of drought. And one of the first signs of drought is yellowing of older leaves. But you also would probably see some other symptoms if that was the case. The plant wouldn't be as vigorous. And you'd see midday cupping and such of the leaves. I mean, so it could be a sign that you were just not quite watering deeply enough or frequently enough or whatever in your particular situation. Also, though, on one of my plants, it's so dense and so vigorous, and it's filling the cage, that the interior leaves way down at the base are yellowing. They're just shading themselves out.
They're done. They're ready to go home. Way.
Yeah, right. They're done. They finished their job. They're handing it off to the next crew. And it's a natural phenomenon. So yellowing of leaves is often, you know, the first starting point is a symptom. The question is, does the plant otherwise look healthy? In this particular case, I think it's just shading itself or, as I say, a possible irrigation symptom. We need to be watering deeply now. You know, we're just past the longest day of the year. We are not cloudy here. We're not overcast. We have unrelenting sunshine. Sunshine all day long. Plants growing very vigorously. And ET rate running a quarter to 0.3 inch a day. You should be deep watering any vine-like vegetable garden plant. So that goes for your pumpkins. It goes for your winter squash. It goes for cucumbers to some degree, although they need more frequent watering as well. And especially goes for your indeterminate tomatoes. Keep them growing if you want that late summer crop that we get here.
So when you're talking about this, so today I have two quotes. One is from Fran Soren and the other from Ken Drews. Fran says, gardening is a sacred act. And Ken says, it's not just plants that grow, but the gardeners themselves.
There you go. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.